Distinguished panelists, ladies and gentlemen, a warm welcome to our online forum on modern warfare and urban security. This forum is again, after several successful cooperation, jointly initiated and organized by Urban Forum, a non-profit association in Austria with the objective of enhancing the meaning of urban municipal local affairs, contributing a modern administrative reform with emphasis on the value of the European Union. And the second organizer is Sinopress, an independent, non-profit and self-supportive media outlet based in Vienna, dedicated to the free expression of cultural and social opinions East and West. My name is Alice Schmatzberger. I'm founder of the platform China Culture Desk based in Vienna, and I have the honor to be your moderator for our today's online forum. Let me shortly introduce the topic today. In the context of our topic, modern warfare and urban security, we are looking forward to discussing the following issues. Destructive means of modern war. Threats to urban security by modern warfare. Worst case scenario of modern wars. Underlying causes of modern wars. Genocide and modern wars. And last but not least, talk about possible solutions to avoid modern wars. So this is the range of topics which we try to discuss today. We are honored to have the following distinguished guests and panelists with us today, of course, all with a profound expertise. I may introduce them. Magister Raphael Spötter, thanks that you are with us, international law expert. Then we have Brigadier Magister Gerhard Rauniak, hello, from the Federal Ministry of National Defense. And we have Professor Mehmet Şükrü Güzel, founder of the Center for Peace and Reconciliation Studies in Switzerland. Welcome. And as Bernhard Müller has mentioned already, Magister Stefan Auer-Stüger, member of the Vienna Municipal Council and State Parliament and speaker of the Austrian Association of Cities, he was also assigned for today as a panelist, but unfortunately he is, because of COVID, at home, and we wish him a very speedy recovery. And Magister Raphael Spötter was so nice on a very short notice to contribute. And not forget, representing the organizers, we have Bernhard Müller from Urban Forum and Helena Chang from Sinopress. So, before we go deep into the discussion and to the panelists' contribution, I would like to give you a short introduction into today's agenda. In the wake of Russian military invasion of the Ukraine, urban security becomes an imminent issue, especially in Europe. The complication of modern warfare with the possible cold, warm, or hybrid forms, and even with the use of energy weapons, requires the development of sophisticated modern approaches to manage collective security, to reshape military-inspired city planning, and to organize city dwellers in case of emergency. At the same time, the background of modern warfare has often to do with geopolitics, as is shown by the Ukraine crisis right now. To understand the direct worries, historical argumentations or pure excuses for raising a war is to help understand how to build a better urban security. One of the excuses Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, used to justify his military invasion of Ukraine is genocide. The term genocide, as a matter of fact, has been often used or misused for different geopolitical considerations in the past years. The upcoming forum today aims to analyze the present geopolitical catalyzers for conflicts of wars, the destructive means to achieve the goals of a modern war, the dangers faced by urban regions, the approaches to enhance the urban security in order to avoid a worst-case scenario, as well as related issues. So this is the foundation outlet for our discussion today. Could I now, to start with our discussion, could I now have the honor to invite at first Magister Raphael Spötter? Please share with us your considerations on the following question. Which destructive means could be used to achieve the goals of a modern war in the 21st century? Please, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation. At first, I think that's a very interesting question. We should, however, talk about the term or the definition of modern war first, I think. In fact, as you might all know, the term war or the concept of war has evolved, and it has indeed changed quite a lot from the 19th century over the 20th until the 21st century. Taking into account the situation or the international system in the late 20th century, we can state that actually the international order was quite that. It was order. It was rather stable, if you like, and you could very well define security policy or security in general. You could analyze the situation in terms of quantities of soldiers, in terms of quantities of tanks or even nuclear weapons. After the dissolution of the Soviet Union, however, the security situation has become increasingly unstable. Wars between states had already become the exception at that point, but now, after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, wars within states became more and more frequent. Think about, for instance, the civil war in Lebanon. Think about the genocide in Rwanda. All these conflicts were actually internal conflicts. So that meant a shift of focus of various international organizations. Beforehand, we had a situation in which wars between states were more rule than exception. And now the situation has shifted, the focus has shifted on conflicts within states that touched upon the very notion of sovereignty of the international order. So the international community had to reassess how to deal with conflict, with military conflict, with armed conflict and war that concerned NATO, the OSCE, the UN, for instance. That shift required now more conflict management and crisis management than that classical, you know, interstate war-like approach with tanks, with nuclear weapons, etc. When you take a look now at the situation in Ukraine, that concept has been brought back to the table. One could very well argue that this is not the first case of, if you like, classical interstate war in recent years. Think of the military conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan, for instance, a couple of years ago. So that is... it might not be the first one, but Vladimir Putin and Russia have actually reintroduced that the idea that you can really change borders, that you can exert pressure by military means in Europe. Now, Russia is an interesting case because when you take into account the conflict I mentioned before, Armenia-Azerbaijan, that war was in fact between two states that were medium-sized, small states with no weapons of mass destruction or nuclear capabilities. That is not the case with Russia. Russia obviously is a nuclear weapon state. It has attacked a neighboring country, a smaller country, Ukraine. And now that is in fact, what we can see now is actually that modern conflict in an interstate setting, if you like. So the war is being fought with modern means, with for instance drones. Forgive me that I just picked that example, but it was quite fresh in my memory because just today I read an article about that. Ukraine has bought Turkish drones, for instance, that are being used against the Russians to surprising effect. So that is a mean of warfare that might be defined as modern, but was in existence maybe a decade ago, but de facto in existence maybe a decade ago. So that's one thing we see. Another thing that can define modern warfare, and that Russia has in fact applied in the past and relatively immediately before they attacked and invaded Ukraine, that is hybrid means. So hybrid means or hybrid warfare, it means in fact non-military means in order to achieve military goals. That is in essence the definition, and it can entail quite a lot of things. For instance, disinformation, cyber attacks, intelligence, reconnaissance, etc. Quite a lot of things that are being used for military purposes, but not necessarily in a military way. We could add, for instance, economic pressure as well to that list, because it's quite a blurry definition, in fact. One of the advantages of that definition, however, is to see and to frame activities that are in fact hostile to one country, but wouldn't be defined as warfare, in fact. And one very interesting point about hybrid warfare is that it can be applied during a formal peacetime, but also during wartime. So Russia can very well continue to spread disinformation, to attack with cyber means, and to continue its covert operations, for instance, in Ukraine, while also bombing Ukraine and attacking it militarily with tanks or fighter jets. So that's the main characteristics of warfare from my point of view. And I hope I highlighted the nature of modern warfare, and I think that the examples I brought are quite appropriate, but I'm giving back to you then.
Thank you very much for that contribution. If I may repeat some keywords to check if I got it right. So the first point was you made a differentiation between there was a shift from war between states to wars within the states. This was one point. Then you mentioned also the Russia-Ukraine conflict now, what we may call modern weapons, although they are in existence decades, maybe nuclear weapons or drones, for example, that may be called modern.
I wouldn't argue that that nuclear weapons are modern weapons as such.
Okay.
Because, yeah. I mean, depends on your definition of modern, of course, but nuclear weapons have been around since 1945, approximately. So what we see is the development of existing weapons or the weaponization of new technologies. That's, in fact, the point. Think of drones, for instance. A drone might have been seen in the 90s, maybe as a toy, you know, the little drone thing you can fly, but it has increasingly been weaponized. So the technology has been developed and continues to be developed, is going to be developed, and now you can use it actually as a weapon in various forms and in various cases. And the same is true, of course, for nuclear weapons, although the type of weapon is not necessarily modern, but the technology with respect to delivering the nuclear warhead, that, for instance, might be defined as modern. Think of hypersonic missiles, for instance.
Okay. And one point you were also mentioning for clarification is hybrid means. And what you're saying was that this is the use of non-military means for military goals, like disinformation, cyber attacks, things like that. Means that could also be applicable in peacetime. So this is, I think, a major differentiation and clarification for further discussion. Okay, thank you very much for that, for the first point. I would like now to turn towards an issue connected to the previous question, and I would like to invite Brigadier Magister Gerhard Rauniak. Hi, thanks that you're with us. I would like to invite you to talk about the following question. What dangers are faced by urban regions that are facing modern warfare?
Hello, I hope my microphone is now working and you can hear me.
I can hear you and see you.
Perfect. Thank you very much for the invitation. Thank you very much, Rafael, for the for your work, because you already explained it very in a very perfect way what modern war fighting in a political from a political view is. I will now take a little bit more the view from a military leader on such kind of operations and warfare. And for the military, modern warfare is a kind of a buzzword for the contemporary type of warfare. It stands normally for very complex and long-term military conflicts, but with a lower intensity. Normally, it's a asymmetric war fighting, which means that both opponents don't have the same level of equipment, training, and personnel and soldiers. This is typically a war between a professional standing army and a resistant movement, militias, but also insurgencies. Urban areas are highly affected of that kind of warfare. And it's very simple to explain why that is the case. Because if you're a weaker opponent, then it's for you very easy to fight in urban areas. You can use the whole infrastructure to hide. You can conduct ambushes behind each corner of a house, behind each window. You can defend that a city. And normally all those defenders have the support from the civilian population, which makes it very easy for them to get the support, to get medical support, and so on. The really great challenge for fighting in urban areas is that it is very, very difficult to distinguish between combatants and the normal civilian population. Because if you see a fighter behind a window, and if you're a soldier, then and you have enormous stress in that situation, you have to decide within seconds: do you shoot or should you not shoot? And this is very challenging. And even if armed forces give their best to protect the civilian population, which we do, for example, we have a very huge training area or training part for our soldiers, how they should behave when they are fighting in urban areas. Nevertheless, you will see victims and there will be high number of refugees. I think I have here an example of the Battle of Mosul. I don't know if you know that. That was a battle between the Allied forces and the Islamic State. It was from 2016 to 2017. It was about 9 months. At the end, the Allied forces had about 1,200 killed soldiers. 5,000 of them were wounded. Islamic State fighters, they had about 5,000 killed fighters. Mm-hmm. And we have seen about 11,000 civilian victims. And this number shows you what the really greatest problem is if you fight in urban areas. So, and the military adopted for that situation in the last 20 years, 30 years. On a political level, of course, we had such initiatives and already international laws implemented to prohibit or at least to limit the use of cluster ammunition and landmines. On a military level, we introduced new special tactics, procedures, and modern weapons in order to avoid those civilian victims and at least nevertheless to reach your military aims. Even the use of precise guided ammunition should help in that. You have seen in the Western military forces a huge step to digitalization. The aim for that is that you get a clear picture of the situation, that you get a clear picture of your own forces, to get a clear picture of the opposing forces, and to get a clear picture of the civilian situation. Nevertheless, you will see a lot of victims in that environment, because that modern warfare sounds very, very good in theory. But at the end, in the reality, it shows that even modern warfare fightings in urban areas are very old style. Because that means you have, of course, the idea to encircle a city or an area, to allow non-combatants to leave that area. And then it depends on your aims. Either you really fight from house to house. And this is a very bloody, it's very bloody fighting, and all military leaders try to prevent that. Or, which is much worse, is you allow non-combatants to exit the city, and then you level the areas block by block with artillery, armor, and airstrikes. And this is exactly what we have seen in Chechnya, in Syria, and partly now in Ukraine. So that is the situation we are facing if we have fightings in urban areas, and we need to find solution for the future for that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for that contribution. May I again repeat some key words to check if I get everything right? You were saying in the beginning that one characteristic of modern warfare is that it is a complex long-term conflict with low intensity and mostly with an asymmetry, with one partner being much stronger than the other. And you were also saying that one characteristics of warfare in urban region is the difficulty to distinguish between fighters and civilian. So you have a lot of civilian victims, like collateral effects, like are they called sometimes.
And the term, but you're right.
Yeah, okay. And you were also saying that modern warfare, when it comes to urban region, is in fact a very old style thing, because you have this to choose between, what did you say, house to house, which is very a bloody thing, or you encircle the city somehow, close it and things like that. So these are the most imminent dangers for urban region when it comes to modern warfare. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And you can follow this this kind of war fighting now in the Ukraine. If you follow on social media, you see the pictures, you see the videos, it's exactly that situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So somehow we have to prevent things like that. Okay, let me focus now on urban security again, how to enhance the urban security in today's world. That means how to avoid the worst case scenario in the wake of possible warfare. If I may invite you again, Brigadier Rauniak, to talk about the possible enhancement of urban security.
From my point of view, the first and most important point to enhance the situation is avoid a war. If we have a war, then we don't have to fight in urban areas. But of course, it's a dream, and it's very unlikely that we can assume that. So from my point of view, you have two possibilities on a very tactical level of that. The first one is to improve the civilian protection within urban areas. And the second one is a more political issue, because we have an agreed international law and we have a law of armed conflict, and each politician, each military leader and each single soldier must be aware of the consequences of his actions in an urban area when he fights there. Mm-hmm. And anyone who commits a war crime is taken to his responsibility with all the hardness we can have, because it's not acceptable to target civilians and non-military objects. So at the end, we have to be very consequent with all those actors who do not apply the rules of international law. Improve civil protection. I think this is not only relevant for war, but it's also for natural disasters, for a blackout or even terrorist attacks. You have to improve the civil protection, which means you need to have the structure and the procedures to have a clear picture about what is going on in your area or in your city. You have to have an alerting system for the population. I just heard today a documentation about the alert system in Germany, which doesn't work very well currently. At the end, it is necessary to invest in that so that you can really alert your population and that you can provide accurate information. For example, if an area is threatened to become a battlefield, and if people should leave the area, and at the end, the people shouldn't be surprised by any action in their surroundings. Then a very important point is that you have to prepare plans. What happens in your area or in your city when the electricity goes down? How to provide the basic needs for the population? And this is something you have to prepare in peacetime. This is nothing mm-hmm. you can do within hours, days, or weeks. You have to prepare that. You have to invest in that, and you have to train your staff on that. The next point is to provide a sufficient number of air raid shelters or bunkers or whatever to protect the civilian population who cannot leave the city. And in the worst case, you have to have a coordinated evacuation of the city or even of parts of the city. Mm-hmm. So these are my two points. First, to apply international law, and second, to improve the civil protection. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much. This is very clear. So the first thing is international law, and the second thing was like civilian plans for urban regions. So how to evacuate, how to secure electricity, water, shelter, things like that. And this is what takes long time for preparing, and which has to be done in peace times. And it's a national task. So it's not the task of each civilian to care for your own water and food. It's a national task. Did I understand that right? So it's the government thing to take care for those infrastructures.
Both, of course, because if you are not able to leave your house for several days, then of course mm-hmm. it's necessary that you have the goods, the water and so on available in your house. So okay. From my point of view, it's a little bit a personal responsibility for each okay. household to prevent it. But nevertheless, civil protection as a system is a governmental issue, of course.
Okay. So it's both. It's like governmental on the meta level, and it's also each person for its own household. Let's say that. Okay. Thank you very much for that very clarification on potential means to enhance urban security. Let's now move on. Some short introduction to the next topic. Recently, Vladimir Putin used the word genocide in justifying his military invasion of Ukraine. As we know, the word genocide was first coined by a Polish lawyer called Raphael Lemkin in 1944 in his book Axis Rule in Occupied Europe. The word genocide consists of like two terms. It's the prefix, a Greek prefix like genos, meaning race or tribe. We have it also in genetics. And then you have a Latin suffix meaning killing. So it's genocide. In 1946, the United Nations General Assembly recognized genocide as a crime under international law. This is what you mentioned before, international law. It was codified as an independent crime in 1948 Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, the so-called Genocide Convention. This convention is signed, meanwhile, by 149 countries as of 2018. In this convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group, such as killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, imposing measures intended to prevent birth within the group, and forcibly transferring children of this group to another group. Let's take a look back in history. In history, the killing of Native Americans was one of the most bloody genocide of indigenous people ever happened in history. Around 130 million of Native Americans were killed, and the population of indigenous Americans declined by 90 to 95% as a result of the massacre of the genocide on Native Americans. Yeah, talking about genocide, the massacre of the Native Americans and its consequences, I would now like to invite once again Magister Raphael Spötter, please, to talk about the following questions. Could you recall some related events concerning genocide crimes, especially in the US since the 1800s, and what about consequences connected to these events? Please, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I think that's quite a difficult question to answer or to deal with in the current context, because when we talk about genocide and the use of the term genocide as used by Vladimir Putin in relation to Ukraine, we're talking about a pretense. It's not that a genocide would have actually happened in eastern Ukraine. That's just something Mr. Putin claims in order to justify his actions with respect to Ukraine. So talking about genocide in from this point of view is a bit difficult, because we shouldn't try to give justification to his argumentation. I think that's just a disclaimer, I think. Related to your question, of course, there have been, and I mean, there were quite a lot genocides in history, unfortunately. With respect to the US in particular, and the Americas, if you like, I just today read something about the actions of Canada, for instance, against the indigenous people in their residential school system first. But we shouldn't try to limit our focus there on America, because in fact, it was also Europeans, and quite a lot of Europeans, committing actually crimes of genocide in the past, most notably, of course, the Germans during World War II, the Nazis committing a genocide against the Jews and other people. Then, of course, if we continue to look at the Germans, then we should think about the genocide against the Herero Nama in today, what is today Namibia. We could also talk about the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, or the Rwandan genocide in the year 1994. And of course, what we should mention is definitely the genocide committed by the so-called Islamic State against the Yazidis from 2014 to I think 2017. So the crime of genocide as such is, of course, a crime according to international law, and we shouldn't, I think we shouldn't limit the focus on just one geographical area, because it's not that people of country X are so prone to commit genocide. That is not the case. In fact, committing the crime of genocide is dependent on the political circumstances, on the social circumstances, and of course it's related to geopolitics in terms of when does a conflict occur. Take for instance the example of the Islamic State and the genocide committed against the Yazidis. That wouldn't have been possible without the Syrian civil war, which in turn was fostered actually by the international system in terms of, maybe not the system, but the states in the international system, international actors. I guess what I'm trying to say is the circumstances, the political in particular, political circumstances must be taken into account. And if I might take something up, the Brigadier General has said, just avoid wars is one point we can actually deal and try to prevent genocide. It's not enough. We have to take into account cultural genocide as well. As you mentioned, the Genocide Convention also notes that genocide can very well be committed by educating people in order to re-educate them, to extinguish their cultures, to extinguish their languages, etc. So that should be absolutely taken into account.
Mm-hmm. So thank you very much for that contribution. So the one thing is that genocide has happened quite often in history already in different parts of the world. And what you said at the beginning of your statement is that you would want to talk about the genocide fact when it comes to the Ukraine conflict, when it comes to the military invasion of Ukraine by Russia, because you said it's a pretendence, because there is no genocide happening, and we should not enhance the argumentation by Vladimir Putin on that point. Did I get you right on that?
Exactly.
Yeah. What my question is, so we said a lot of genocide is happening and has happened. What are consequences of genocide crimes? Is it like extinguishing of specific groups, or could you shortly elaborate on that aspect of the question?
Well, of course, the ultimate goal of genocide obviously is to eliminate a particular group of people defined in the Genocide Convention. That might relate to religious beliefs, that might relate to language or to ethnicity. So that definition is quite open. Mm-hmm. It is not defined how many people of one group you actually have to kill or to re-educate, so that genocide is constituted, that genocide is committed. So that definition is quite open. However, it's rather difficult to argue that a genocide has happened if it concerns quite a few people. I mean, if you it's a horrible example, but if you think of what's happening in Ukraine right now, or has happened in Syria, the Russian army, the Russian armed forces, or the Syrian armed forces encircling cities and killing combatants and many civilians, that wouldn't be a genocide crime, because it's not actually about killing the entire group or extinguishing the entire group of people. That is the main motivation has to be extinguishing a group in accordance to the Genocide Convention, and if that motivation is not given, then it frankly it's not no genocide. And mm-hmm. with if we think about Ukraine at this moment, or between 2014 until now, there were no signs of ethnic Russians being targeted in Ukraine to extinguish that group, on the contrary. So arguing that the genocide would be ongoing, even if there were killings, could have been mass killings, I don't know. There were some reports about that, but it was not systematically, and it didn't, I mean, you can't argue that it happened. So the main point about genocide is that it has to target really the group of people as defined, and then trying to extinguish that group. And the consequence, of course, that is absolutely a crime against humanity.
Okay. Thank you very much for that clarification. That's a very important point. Coming back from looking into history to a present issue, is Professor Dr. Güzel still with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Ah, hi, I can see you again. Hi. Welcome. You are an expert on UN conventions, and you have recently written on the issue of genocide. Would you please share with us your considerations on how to interpret the meaning of genocide, especially in the context of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and how to prevent the misuse of the term genocide in future? Would you please elaborate on this?
Thank you very much. And it's really a great pleasure for me to participate in your symposiums and meetings. Well, I prepared a speech and I have got my notes, but it's always good to simultaneously speak. Sometimes it is better to use like Ukraine as a case study to really tell the problems like the usage of genocide and how we can also create the peace, and how if we really define the solution clearly, maybe we can have some other words for creating the peace. Genocide, as our colleagues had mentioned, that you mentioned, and as everybody knows, it's the crimes of the crimes, and it's a crime, and it's our obligation to prevent genocide. And to prevent genocide is a JUCO gas bomb. That is, it's an obligation, and according to the International Court of Justice on Srebrenica case, genocide case, it's an obligation of the states to prevent, subject to its limitations. But other than that, we have got to define how to act within the concept of UN Charter and the UN Collective Security Mechanism to prevent a genocide. This is an important issue. That is, when we come to the point of state sovereignty and its relation with its citizens, and when the legality of use of force is changed by the UN, we know the hybrid wars and proxy wars. And genocide, in that sense, I'm not talking about Ukraine now, but in general, is a good point. I mean, during the decolonization period, we have got the national liberation movements. What is the meaning of national liberation movements? They have got the right to kill people with uniform, and they are subject to Geneva Conventions by the United Nations. Especially this is the case against Portugal in Angola. And on the decolonization, the attack of India to Goa is subject to decolonization. But when the decolonization process has finished, and of course we have got so much human rights problems, genocide is chosen to create some non-state actors not to be defined as terrorists, but to be used as a national liberation movement in a different sense, because in the Geneva Convention, the ethnic minority is focused. I mean, there is a definition of nation, and any minority group can claim that they are subject to genocide. so that they can be named as a national liberation movement. They will not be taken, they will not be put under the definition of terrorism, and they have got a right to fight to form anti-independent states. It's sometimes reality that there exist the conditions of not living together, and this is how the formulation of remedial suggestion. When we come to the point of the UN mechanism, it is not as easy. In fact, in the UN system, unknowingly, was focused on preventive of genocide with its mechanism after the Bosnian and Rwanda genocide, after the Balkan Wars. The UN has two special rapporteurs subject to the Secretary General. Special advisor of the Secretary General on the prevention of genocide, special advisor of the Secretary General on the responsibility protect, and it's an early warning mechanisms. And the special rapporteur on the prevention of genocide is mandated to alert the Secretary General and through him the Security Council. And then if there is a problem in the world which is amount to a genocide, and if there is an obligation of to prevent, it's an obligation of the United Nations. The United Nations will follow up the world, and the special rapporteur has an obligation to inform the Secretary General. This is not a case, most interestingly, for Ukraine. And also, it is not by of choice. And we have got a system of framework of analysis for atrocity crimes. And this is a really good work. And this is an early warning mechanism of the United Nations. And if anything happens in a country, and if it fulfills the framework of the atrocity crimes, the special advisor gets into an action. So, but the states do not like this. Because it is, again, the political usage of genocide. Genocide is an interesting word. I mean, everybody now uses of the Srebrenica case to say that there is a genocide. It's real genocide, to killing 8,000 around Bosnian people when they don't have any arms. It is much more than accepted as a crime against humanity or war crimes, because they don't want them to live. But there is also a forgotten case of International Court of Justice. This is really important. Between Serbia and Croatia on the judgment application of the Convention on Genocide. And that, when the use of force has been, when both sides used force for ethnic cleansing, the International Court of Justice said that even included some amount of people being killed. Unfortunately, sometimes the death of the people are in numbers, but even some more than the people were dead, more than the amount of in Srebrenica when the International Court of Justice accepted as genocide, the International Court of Justice said that there is no genocide, it's ethnic cleansing. And the use of force and killing of the civilians are in a different sense. So it is not an easy case, I mean, to define something as a genocide. To be a genocide, we need two things, I mean, one is the mens area, criminal mind, dolus specials, to intent to destroy, and the other one is actus reus, cruelty act. So the criminal mind, the special intent to destroy a specific group, is the most important thing if there is a genocide or not. I recently wrote an article on the so-called Uyghur genocide or other Muslim minority case in Xinjiang. It is really interesting. A so-called tribunal in United Kingdom said that there is a genocide is going from there. But to form the genocide, they have to first prove that there is a special mind. And I will come to the Ukraine. But this is really important. Where is the missing point on Russia? They said that there is a genocide by extant birth control and sterilization. This is the criminal side of it. But to show that there is a special intent, they use something very interesting. They wrote in their judgment that to transform the region into a more integrated part of China for, amongst other purposes, economic benefit. And Xinjiang is a territory of China, and the integration, economic integration, here is defined the intent. And when they say that the birth control policy of China is the same for all ethnic groups, that is 56 ethnic groups. But when it is being used in different political senses, sometimes the lawyers try to create a genocide. And for example, as I mentioned, they do not apply
to Ukraine
form of framework of atrocity crimes. When we come to the Ukraine, this is the most interesting part. There is OSCE group monitoring the two regions, and there is so much violations of ceasefire, and especially from Ukrainian side. But the violation of ceasefires amounted to genocide is something different. Not the implementation of the Minsk II agreement is different. And most interestingly, Russia said that we do not use force according to the Genocide Convention. 2 days ago, the International Court of Justice had given its accepted the application of Genocide Convention on the provisional measures against Russia. And there, Russia said that the special military operation conducted by Russia into the territory of Ukraine, is based on the United Nations Charter, its Article 51, and customary international law. In the note that Russia had given to the United Nations is that we are using Article 51, that is the use of force on self-defense. But the International Court of Justice did not accept this exception because subject to the press releases of the Russia. Now we come to a 2 point. Even if there is a genocide going on in some place, what is the UN collective security system to act on behalf of it? And what can happen if the system in the UN Security Council is blocked by the veto power? Mm-hmm. I mean, according to that, in the Kampala Review Conference on the Rome Study, the United States proposed an understanding aimed at carving out an exception on the crime of aggression. It says that any act undertaken in connection with an effort to prevent commission of any of the crimes contained, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, would not constitute an act of aggression. This was not accepted on the Kampala Review Conference of the Rome Study. But this is the point of the United States. And this is the legal background of the humanitarian intervention in Kosovo, which resulted as the burden of responsibility to protect. But the responsibility to protect used in a different sense in Libya. I am telling in a short time with different things making confusion. But we have got two things. One, what we have in our hand, the Geneva Convention and the mechanism of the UN to prevent genocide within the UN Security Council. If the UN Security Council, if comes to a position like the Balkans in 1990 for the Kosovo, for any peacekeeping operations, then it comes to the legitimization or legalization of the unilateral use of force like the United States and NATO make. But in another form, the Genocide Convention is an obligation that mustn't be used for political reasons. When we come to the point of Ukraine, the war crimes of the Ukraine army, and both sides made war crimes, are not subject to Jugogens, and it is not accepted by the United Nations or any other forms. This is the reason Russia, when sent a letter to the United Nations Secretary General, their use of force are subject to self-defense. When it is subject to self-defense, will that give, now we came to the position, two regions, and what will be the peace narrative?
Okay.
And I would like to say something for the future. The United States will never accept any peace treaty that will be signed by with Russia and Ukraine, subject to the customary foreign policy of the United States of America on non-recognition, because there is, I just want to remind something, the Soviet annexion of Estonia, Lithuania, and Lithuania was never recognized as legal till 1990, when the Baltic states each individually their independence from Soviet Union. Now it's a little bit complicated, but
okay, let's come to one point. You mentioned very different and very many points. Let me try to wrap up somehow what you were mentioning. A lot of points. One of very interesting points where you were mentioning the connection between genocide, crime against humanity, and ethnical cleaning. So this is one point we need to be very clear which term means what. You were also talking about the UN mechanism, and did I get it right that the Ukraine-Russian conflict is not subject to any UN mechanism? Did I get that right?
On genocide side.
Yeah, the focus is now on genocide. Yeah.
On genocide side, the UN mechanism said that there is no genocide going on because the special representative of Secretary General within his mandate never and never sent a letter to the Secretary General on the subject to be taken to the United Nations Security Council.
Okay.
So this is the proof that there is no genocide is going on. But when we come to the point of daily use of genocide, when the political groups wants to use genocide, this is a threat to world peace and security, by which they want to create proxy wars, and they want to create so-called national liberation movements, and they want to legalize another civil war, another proxy civil war. This is the most important case, in my sense, on the misuse of genocide.
You were also mentioning, if I get it right, that the UN Convention on Genocide, that it is also a responsibility to prevent genocide.
Yes.
It's also a legal obligation. Did I get that
legally,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
It's a legal obligation, and it is within the limits of every state. I mean, for example, if there was a genocide going on in any country in Africa, a Pacific Island state has an obligation as well, with its capacity.
Okay. Yeah.
That is to cut off diplomatic relations. This is what is in different meaning of sanctions. But it's obligation of humanity.
Yeah. Prevention. Okay. So we have seen now in your statement how complicated the relationship is between national liberation movements, ethnical cleaning, crimes against humanity, and under what circumstances the term genocide is applicable to a conflict. So this is like a very, very complex relationship, I think.
It's really complex. I mean, genocide is a strong word by which sometimes foreign-sponsored groups or other groups can survive in diaspora.
Yeah.
And they want to take the political representative control of the national groups. I mean, if a group says that there is a genocide, they automatically, in a political psychology, take control of the representative of that nation or minority group in the world, and they become somehow a national liberation movement, even without using guns.
Okay. Thank you very much, Professor Güssel, for highlighting these complex relationships and on how many different levels one have to think. We have now talked about genocide as one potential excuse for raising a war or as one potential justification for military invasion. I would now like to go one step further because there are other excuses for waging a war as well. Maybe we can have one again, Mr. Raphael Spötter. In your observation, we have heard now a lot of genocide as potential excuse. What other excuses or justifications are there for waging a war against other countries? Which other terms are relevant in this connection?
Okay, thank you for the question. It's, from my point of view, a very important one. Professor Güssel has mentioned beforehand the Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations, which certified the right of each state for individual self-defense, and in addition to that, collective self-defense. I would like to add another very important article of the UN Charter, which might have been overlooked in the past few years, in particular by Russian President Putin, and that is Article 2, Number 4, which reads, all members of the United Nations shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state or in any other manner inconsistent with the purposes of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. In brief, this means war is illegal, period. Mm-hmm. You can't wage a war against any other state. Now, there are, I wouldn't say exceptions to that rule, but in light of Article 51, we have to take into account self-defense and collective self-defense. This means that any state that is being attacked by another state might call for aid. So its allies might help that state in defending itself. And in addition to that, Article 51 says quite explicitly that individual self-defense by that state is legal, is absolutely fine until the Security Council takes measures. Because mm-hmm. if the Security Council takes measures, and measures meaning voting on a resolution, adopting a resolution, and then allowing other states to assist that one state that's being attacked, the Security Council has the responsibility of, in this system of collective self-defense. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, we can argue as well with the Charter of the United Nations, I think it's Chapter 8, which allows regional organizations to take up measures of collective self-defense. That, for instance, might serve as legal basis for NATO, that might serve as, in the past, legal basis for the Warsaw Pact or any other military alliance, in fact. So if you take a look from that point of view, legally, war is absolutely not allowed unless it's for self-defense, and then you can have other states joining in as well, if you like.
So far when it comes to theory and paper, but in reality...
So far when it comes to theory and paper, of course. Yeah. I mean, you could also argue that this is the one thing international law actually has achieved, because every state now argues why its actions are actually in accordance with international law. Okay. So no state would say, okay, I'm just deliberately breaking Article 2, Number 4 of the Charter of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. They would argue why their actions are actually legal and in accordance with that article. For instance, if you take into account the war in Yemen that is being waged by Saudi Arabia, they could very well have argued the head of state of Yemen has come for aid because they tried to depose him. So, but they being the Houthis, of course, trying to depose him. That's another point, because if a state invites any other state to come to its assistance, that's legal as well, because of the right to self-defense.
Mm-hmm.
So that is something we should bear in mind, of course. And then, if you can't really justify war in mm-hmm. this situation, you can just argue why someone goes to war and what's the real deal behind it. Because reasons for war include, for instance, the need for resources or political power or the greed, if you like, for territory. In the current case, Russia against Ukraine, we could argue, or some people have argued, that actually the background of that is the interest, the security interest of the Russian Federation to keep Ukraine out of NATO. So there are interests why states wage wars, but you actually cannot argue that war is legal, so we can wage it if we like, and we can justify it in the corners of international law. That is not possible.
Okay, so this is like what the UN regulations provide is like a common ground saying there is no justification of peace for war. Sorry. And if you are breaking these rules, then you have to look for like excuses, argumentations, like, I don't know, what did you say, resources, political power. So you have to develop an argumentation. Why are you breaking those UN regulations? Does this
basically
common ground?
I mean, you don't have to. The best thing would be not to go to war in the first place. But that's what states are trying to do. Another example for that is, for instance, the Iraq war in 2003, in which, in particular, the United Kingdom has argued that the UN resolution dealing with the Iraqi Kuwaiti issue in 1991 has never been put out of, it was still up, basically. So the UK has argued that due to this resolution, its war against Iraq was legal because it was authorized by UN Security Council in order to bring back stability to the region, because it was not outdated, or there was no deadline day until the UN said, okay, until then, and then it's over. So that's now the case in many operations and missions. There is now a date until the, when the mandate ends of that particular mission, in part because of that argumentation. But the UN realized we can't have never-ending resolutions, because that mm-hmm. would be impossible. So they have now an ending date and then have to be prolonged. So that's basically another example.
Yeah, the common ground, yeah. Okay, so for closing our forum, I would like to go to the last round, because our panelists during the discussion have sometimes mentioned it would be best not to go to war. So this time, this term we have heard like, I don't know, 3 or 4 times during this discussion, of course. So we didn't have prepared any input for that. But do you have any idea if the best thing is not to go to war, how to avoid modern wars in the first place? I know it's topic for a different forum, but maybe we can, like, for a short round, you may contribute some keywords, all of you. And if I may, I would like to start with Brigadier Rauniak for the last round. Do you have any keywords, like any ideas, what would be necessary to prevent modern wars? For a last round, please.
Yeah, that's a really perfect question. And if you can answer that question, you could be, I think, very rich.
Nobel Prize.
Yeah, at least. for me, there is only one way in the current situation and or in the current international system, that you have to comply with international law and you have to talk to each other. And at the end, you have to find a compromise and you have to live with that compromise. It's always to have a compromise, even if it's not the best compromise, it's better than to go to war.
Okay. So it's like an appeal to the Russia and Ukraine.
I think it will not be enough for the Nobel Prize, but nevertheless.
Yeah, but it's not about, I find this contribution in so far important because it's not about that everybody is buying, I say it in a very simplistic way, now buying more tanks and building up more soldiers, but there is another thing, and that would be talking about the international law, talking in the diplomatic channels, keeping them open, things like that. So this would be also.
I am a military, but I have to be honest. Yeah. Military is not always for a problem.
Military diplomacy.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you very much. I would also like to ask Professor Bissell, you have any idea, a very short contribution, some keywords, what is necessary to avoid modern warfare in future the best as we can?
The answer is in real politics. It's impossible to prevent war within different senses, but we can prevent the big powers war. This is the most important. There will be always small wars within the states, minority rebellions or racist regime with around 200 states. But the United Nations mechanism was established for the hegemonic stability. It's a different balance of power. And Russia used a pretext of Article 51, but they could not still fulfill under it as a preventive measure of war in different senses. But we have to create different kind of mechanisms. That is the missing point. Within the big powers, many nations ask for reform in the United Nations, but I am a little bit afraid of it because we need hegemonic stability. Okay. If we ask for justice and democratic United Nations, unfortunately, it can create anarchy and chaos. The humanity is not still at that point. And for the first time, the war is forbidden within the UN Charter. We have to create a different kind of mechanism. Cold War was a balance of power. Now the Ukraine crisis is the problem of balance of power and changing. Which mechanisms can we create yet? And the Ukraine war, now I'm afraid will come to a different position because I am sure that the United States of America will never accept the peace treaty. And they will use the non-recognition tradition of the Baltic states. In that sense, how we can achieve peace within the accepted concept of balance of power and stability. But it means economic stability, because if Russia loses, this is what is going to be for the future. And if it turns to be a war of Syria, which is going something like that, the loss of power of Russia will create other problems within the world, and the world economy will be affected. And we also need to understand the reason of the Second World War or the First World War. So I am so much afraid, and I do ask for a fast solution of the Ukraine increase, but we need still a hegemonic stability. And balance of power that we need.
Okay, and to develop some different
mechanism between the two states or three states or five states, but big states, we need them to be in communication.
Okay, thank you very much for that contribution. Last not least, Mr. Spötter, some ideas, keywords. What is necessary now in future?
Well, it's a very tough question, of course.
It would be a different forum.
It would definitely be a different forum. My two previous speakers already argued that the balance of power on the one hand and diplomacy on the other hand are two aspects that are essential to achieve peace or at least to avoid war. I would subscribe to that, but I would also add that we have to take into account the economic and social circumstances of the respective populations. We're not talking necessarily about interstate war, but also about intrastate war, which means wars within states or civil wars. I don't really see any way forward without asking questions of social equality, of mm-hmm. integration into society, of inclusion, of economic fairness, etc., mm-hmm. etc. So these points have to be taken into account. And of course, there is always geopolitics to be reckoned with. But I think there is a very good point in arguing we have to deal with a imperfect situation and try to align interests of the great powers in order to avoid a major war. Mm-hmm. And in Europe, at least in this particular case, I would argue that we have to deal in the future with Russia under any circumstances. Russia is not going anywhere, if you like. Russia is going to be our neighbor, and we have to deal with our neighbor. We have to integrate Russia into a security architecture, a new security architecture in Europe, and we have to be fair and to be open to Russia, actually. This is not to excuse the invasion of Ukraine, of course. This is not to argue that Russia had no other choice or was forced to do that by NATO. I think the opposite of that is true. But in fact, we have to deal with Russia. We have to deal with that neighbor. And a security system in Europe is not going to be sustainable with an antagonistic Russia, yeah. in any case. So that's for me, one of the main points of the current crisis. And we have to bear that in mind in the future when we deal with Russia.
Okay, thank you very much for that contribution. So it somehow wraps up all those contributions. It means to deal with Russia in the future when establishing a new security architecture in Europe, we have to keep open the diplomatic channels and the talk diplomacy, as Brigadier Rauniak said. And we also need to take into account what you mentioned, like economic and social circumstances when developing, as Professor Bissell said, new mechanism how to deal with those in future.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, all of our panelists, for your time and your expertise and sharing your ideas and knowledge with us. Let me also thank the organizers for choosing a highly hot topic and to give the floor and the opportunity to talk about things that are going on at the moment. Yeah, I would like now to close the forum, and in doing so, I would give the floor to Bernhard Müller from one of the organizers from Urban Forum, and he will say some closing words and officially end our forum. Bernhard, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Alice, dear ladies, gentlemen, distinguished panelists, dear guests. It's a great pleasure to be here with you. Let me try to do some closing remarks and a closing statement. Alice said it in the right way, a very interesting topic, warfare and urban security. After the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the bipolar world order, many of us believed that golden times were ahead. For a few years after the fall of the Iron Curtain, there was a real spirit of optimism. The famous political scientist Francis Fukuyama even spoke of the end of history. But it turns out that there is no end of history. There are even terrible developments in history repeating themselves, which hardly anyone would have thought possible. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has shown that old threats like war are still real. New threats have been added, such as environmental destruction, climate change, new forms of slavery, cybercrime, and especially terrorism. The terrorist attack in Vienna in autumn 2021 showed that there is no place in the world that is forever spared from terror. Anyone who visits large cities in Europe on a professional or private basis will notice the many construction measures that have been built to defend against terrorism. Think about the square in front of the Vienna City Hall. In this sense, there are also concrete threats and bollards in Vienna to prevent assassins from driving vehicles into crowds of people at events. Therefore, politics and administrations of cities will increasingly have to deal with the issue of urban security. Brigadier Raniak spoke about this topic. Our forum, Urban Forum Institute, is very grateful to Sinopress for choosing today's topic, and we will be covering it again and again in the months and years to come. Hardly any of us could have imagined that there would be another war of aggression in Europe in 2022. We must not forget the war in Yugoslavia from 1991 onwards, but that war originated within the country itself. It's necessary to say, I think. It was not an attack from outside. Since 1945, there has not been a situation like today. And so in this way, it's a turning point in time that requires a rethink. Anyone who sees the pictures from the bombed civilian neighborhoods of Kiev knows that from now on, cities will also have to prepare for this form of defense against attacks and for providing for the population in a state of war, whether digital hacker attacks or bomb attacks. The threats to city as living spaces are real. That is a sad realization. I thank our great moderator, Alice, our great partner, Helena from Sinopress, and the panelists for their expertise and valuable discussion. As always, dear ladies and gentlemen, this forum was recorded, will be transcribed and will appear as an online brochure. Thank you very much. Stay well. All the best and goodbye. And we wish a peaceful future. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye.